Welcome back to the program. Back in the Middle Ages, human life expectancy was around 30. By the 1900s, average life expectancy rose 47 years, an increase of about 30 years over 8 centuries. But needless to say, things have speeded up considerably. Over the past century, we've added another 30 years to our life expectancy. Nowadays, we expect to increase an amazing 2 years per decade, which translates into 5 hours per day. And there are scientists working today who are close to adding not mere hours, but centuries to our lives. We're going to talk about this quest for immortality with my guest, Jonathan Weiner. He's one of our most distinguished science writers. His books have won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. He's a former editor of The Sciences and a writer for The New Yorker. He's the author of the previous bestseller, The Beak of the Finch. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new work, Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. Jonathan Weiner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, it's my pleasure.
Talk a little bit about the skepticism that you approached this project with in terms of what you thought was possible in terms of longevity.
Strong skepticism. I think anyone who's looked at the subject knows that every generation yearns for immortality all the way back to the beginning of time. The very first stories ever written were stories about hopes of heroes to conquer death. We're no different. And so you have to be very skeptical of claims that we can do something to slow aging or conquer aging. And yet the research is more promising now than it has been before. And so there's just a little bit more reason to hope that this subject is becoming accessible to science at last.
And of course, there's two parts of it. There's extending life and extending the quality of life.
That's right. We want to live longer. We don't want to be dying longer, God forbid. And it's hard to know whether the one project wouldn't shade into the other.
Talk a little bit about the people that you started to talk to, the areas you looked at in terms of some of the work that's being done.
Well, I've been interested in this subject, I have to say, since the beginning, since I was starting out as a science writer, when I interviewed an elderly biologist who was almost alone in her field at the time, Maria Rudzinska at Rockefeller University. Back in the early 1980s, she was in her early 80s herself, and she was trying to understand what aging is, and it was a subject that science just didn't go there. She was really one of the very few. And since then, since that interview, I've followed the field as it's grown. And I've interviewed quite a few impresarios of rejuvenation research over the years, and one grand old man of molecular biology who engineered a Methuselah fly, Seymour Benzer. And I kept watching for a way to write a book about this. And then in the early 1990s, I ran across a then obscure character named Aubrey de Grey in Cambridge, England, and started talking with Aubrey and decided that he was my main character. He was a fascinating character to carry a book like this.
And he alone is enough to make one excited about the idea of prolonging the possibility of life into centuries.
Well, he's excited, that's for sure. I always feel a little queasy when I talk with Aubrey, and I've been candid about that from our first conversation. I'm not writing as a disciple of Aubrey's, but Aubrey does argue that we can live for thousands of years, that we should live for thousands or tens of thousands of years, that the means are within reach at last, and we should go for it. And he's very, very convincing salesman for the idea.
How does he make this argument in light of what we know about the biology of cells themselves and the way they age?
Well, he argues that we've all been there already. Our bodies were really great at maintaining themselves when we were 10, 11, 12 years old. You know, in actuarial terms, if you could st- today as healthy as you were then, and not decline over the decades, you would have a good shot at living 1,000 years. And the outliers, you know, the super centenarians, would be super millenarians. They would live for tens of thousands of years. The rare old ones. So all you have to do, Aubrey says, and you know, that's, I have to put that in some kind of skeptical quotes, but all you have to do is you have to maintain your body as well as you did when you were a kid. And we maintain treasured antique cars or beautiful old houses by keeping up the repairs. So he says, let's figure out how to do that for ourselves. Our cells aren't so good at taking out the garbage, so to speak. Yeah. As we get older, they start filling up with all kinds of molecular junk that they can't get rid of. You know, it's almost the equivalent of that elderly pack rat in your family who has stacks and stacks of the New York Times or the local paper going back a decade or two, and all the bills, you know, wrapped in twine going back 20 years. So our cells are like that. After a while, they start filling up with all kinds of malevolent crud, and it's different crud in your brain cells from the garbage that builds up in your heart cells. But on and on, it's a cleanup job, Aubrey says, and he's proposed 7 different, somewhat odd, eccentric, out of left field ideas for helping the cells clean up that crud.
Talk a little bit about what those ideas are.
Well, he calls it the 7 deadly things. As opposed to 7 deadly sins of the Middle Ages, it's these 7 deadly things that bring us down. And you know, with the brain, you have plaques that are connected with Alzheimer's disease. You have beta amyloid. You have crud called lipofuscin, and I'm using the word crud. You know,
right.
there are more technical terms, but that's essentially what we're talking about. And it fills even in the cells of your retinas. I was talking with a scientist who specializes there in the study of the retina. And she asked me, actually, this is on my mind today just because of the, I'm wearing a black sweater and gray pants. She said, so do you find you have more trouble now in your 50s telling apart the blue socks from the black socks? And I said, well, yeah, come to think of it, I do. I hadn't thought about it. And she said, that's because lipofuscin is building up this molecular trash in your retinas, and you're having more and more trouble telling the two apart. There's other kinds of molecular damage building in the lenses of your eye, the crystalline lenses of your eye. I was going to say there's no limit to the range of junk, but there is. There are, to Aubrey, 7 broad categories. You know, then there's also the atherosclerotic plaques, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So all we need to do, again, is come up with enzymes or drugs that can clean up that crud that our bodies neglect to get rid of.
And what have you found in terms of the way other scientists that work in the area of aging and longevity, how did they respond to ideas like Aubrey de Grey's?
Well, there's a whole range. I mean, Aubrey's a very controversial guy. He, for obvious reasons. Anybody who stands up and says, we can live 1,000 years, follow me. you know, the mainstream in his field, which is called gerontology, the study of aging, the study of lifespan, the mainstream is not with Aubrey on that. But his specific ideas, some of them, are very interesting. And so serious scientists do collaborate with Aubrey. When I say serious, I'm not saying he isn't, but mainstream, well-accepted leaders of gerontology co-author papers with Aubrey about ideas like what you do about that lipofuscin building up in the retina. And I could tell you his most far-out idea that has actually gotten some traction. He was thinking about the all this range of indigestible crud in the cells, and he thought, where, if our bodies haven't figured out how to digest it and get rid of it, there must be some living thing somewhere that has figured out the problem, and that maybe we could learn from them how to do it. And then he thought, bizarrely enough, of graveyards. Now, again, he's from Cambridge, England. They have some very ancient graveyards in Cambridge, England, going back centuries upon centuries. He figured the bacteria, the bugs in the soil of those graveyards must have specialized in stripping skeletons of all of their machinery, including all of the junk. And so he collaborated with an expert in what's called bioengineering and bioremediation, looking at bacteria to try to find enzymatic tools that can clean up oil spills, for instance. That's a classic problem there. And he said, why couldn't we use these same approaches instead of cleaning up oil spills or toxic waste dumps, clean up elderly aging bodies? Maybe there are drugs to be found in examining how the bacteria in old English graveyards do it. So they started on that work, and it's been picked up by some of the world's leading experts in bioengineering and bioremediation. So they're taking some of the ideas. They're cherry picking, I think, mm-hmm. from Aubrey de Grey, and he's got. You know, he's a fountain of this kind of off-the-wall but interesting proposal.
The other side of this is that even if he is partially right, even if we can live for 100 years with some degree of certainty or hundreds of years, in fact, the public policy considerations with respect to that are pretty overwhelming in and of themselves.
Hugely, you're right. And I argue in the book, in fact, that they're at least as complicated as the medical problem. Mm-hmm. You know, there's can we, which we've been talking about, and then there's should we. And should we is enormously complicated because, I mean, look at the struggles we're having now over the question of raising retirement age by a year or two. I mean, what do you do if suddenly, over the course of just a couple of years, there's a pill out there that gives you an extra decade or an extra century even. Everything, every human institution, social institution you can think of is turned on its head. I mean, think of marriage. Marriage, to death do us part. What if that is a pledge of 1,000 years or more? Does that change the nature of the pledge? Does it make marriage less attractive, less conceivable for people? For some people, I think it probably would.
Mm-hmm.
So what about leaders? What about dictators? I mean, look at the revolutions we're watching right now. What if Mao had had a chance to live 1,000 years? What if Hitler had had a chance to preside over his 1,000-year Reich personally? You know, most dictators don't live out their natural lives, or many of them don't. But enough do that it's a scary thought that you could have a really, really bad person running the show for a really long time.
Beyond the economic and political consideration is just the psychological aspect of this. So much of how we approach life, how we approach the world, comes from that knowledge that, you know, whether it's at 60 or 80 or 90, that in fact our life is going to end at some point. And to take that away changes so many other things.
You're right. And that fascinates me, too. I think in some ways, that's what I find the most fascinating problem of all here. I mean, it's so hard for us to cope with being mortal. You know, in some ways, it's our biggest challenge spiritually and intellectually, and we start on it from almost as soon as we're thinking, you know, and almost, you know, from childhood we've been thinking about this. Mm-hmm. And if you suddenly remove that that core problem, you have removed something that's at the core of being human. Mm-hmm. And at the core of what it means to grow and mature and find your, I don't know, find your home in the universe. We are mortals. That problem defines us literally.
Mortality is inherently humbling in so many respects.
That's
even if you approach it as an atheist, it is still a humbling process.
Hugely humbling. That's right. Gets more humbling by the year.
Right.
So Aubrey is not a particularly humble guy, as he would be the first to tell you, and Aubrey would argue that you and I, when we talk this way, are just being apologists for death. We're defending death because we think there's no alternative. We're defending aging because we think there's no alternative. But he thinks we're talking humbug. He thinks that as serious as all these problems are, if you could remove them, almost none of us would hesitate to take that magic pill. And I think that is an interesting argument to make, at least. It's an argument Aubrey and I have had over many a round of beers.
Right.
Because I should add that Aubrey, although he has a great faith in the human body's ability to last 1,000 years, also tends to undermine it by drinking from morning till night. And that's cost him a little bit of credibility, but I think he's willing to pay the price because he really enjoys his beer.
The other aspect is the degree to which the scientific work on this, maybe not by Aubrey, but certainly by others, the way the scientific work is impacted by these things that we have been talking about before, and the knowledge and the concern with respect to consequences.
Well, yeah, it's a sensitive area. On the one hand, we want this kind of research to go forward for many good reasons. I mean, what we're talking about here is essentially the medical program writ large. We're all in favor of people trying to find a cure for cancer, for Alzheimer's, for heart disease, for diabetes, and so on. That we all want that. How different then is it to say we're trying to conquer aging? It may be that conquering all those diseases requires doing something about the body's gradual accumulation of junk, for instance, Aubrey's argument. If that's the case, then you're fighting aging and you're fighting all those other diseases at once. So that's great. And we all would want that, I think. And probably we should be spending more research dollars to do it rather than focusing, say, on cancer or atherosclerosis or Alzheimer's. You should look at ways to prevent all this deterioration that makes those diseases more likely to by the year. So that's all really strong. On the other hand, it's politically untouchable for a politician to say, I think we should have a well-funded program to conquer aging. That you'd be laughed out of Washington.
The reality is that it's not a zero-sum game, that it is not all or nothing. And in fact, the first step in this process, I think that most credible scientists would agree, is trying to improve the quality of life within the context of life expectancy today. And to the extent that we can do that, that you can be 90 and 100 years old and be free of so many of these diseases and problems, that if we can get to that point, then we can maybe begin to talk about the next step. But it's not going to be 0 to 1,000 all at once.
That's almost certainly true. But there's a little bit of a paradox there that I learned in working on this book that I hadn't really seen before. It's easier politically to say we're not trying to extend to break any age barrier. You know, we're not trying to add decades to life. We're just trying to improve the decades we have. The phrase that gerontologists will use is, we're not trying to add years to life, but life to years, make them good years. It really isn't that different, again. I mean, if you're trying to improve quality of life and improve the health of people in the second half of their lifespans, then you're really doing the same kind of thing that Aubrey is, say, in trying to cure aging. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to make us healthy longer. And the longer we are healthy, the longer we will live.
It is interesting to think of aging in and of itself as a disease. You know, we tend to think of the diseases that happen while we age, but the idea of aging in and of itself as a disease is sort of an interesting and different way to think about it.
It is, and it's very hard for us to think that way. And yet, the truth is, nobody really knows what we mean by aging. When I talk about this with people, they'll often say, how can you call aging a disease? On the other hand, what is it that we're talking about? We can't be so categorical about not working on a problem when we can't even define what that problem is. It's as elusive as consciousness right now. Biologists can't say what it is about the body is changing day by day, week by week, year by year, that produces all the effects we think of as aging. And until they can, it's not so obvious what the pill should do if you want that pill, and whether there is a distinct phenomenon called aging, or if it is just slowly accumulated damage that then expresses itself in one of these very recognizable disease patterns.
It's interesting, too, that there are really, it seems, two worlds that we're talking about. One is the world of science, and that's really where we've been talking and what we've been discussing. But then there's the kind of shadow world of medicine and doctors who are treating this on a day-to-day basis, who look at it entirely differently.
Well, yeah, I guess the researchers in gerontology are arguing about can you add 20, 30, 50 years to life. The doctors are there in the day-to-day dealing with our humble list of very familiar diseases.
Right.
You know, so that is very different. But what part of the reason it's so different is that what the scientists can see in the labs really does inspire some hope that you could begin to do something about aging. And we should mention that you can tweak the genes of a fruit fly in the lab or a worm in the lab and make it into a Methuselah of its kind. It'll live twice as long, or a worm with changing one gene will live 10 times as long as all the other worms in the lab.
Mm.
So if you can do that, then might there be clues there that would lead to Methuselahs among human beings? We're not that different at the level of our metabolism, at the level of those genes. It really might be possible to do something. And that's why there's that gap you're talking about between the perspective of the scientists in the labs and the doctors, doctors in the clinics and the hospitals.
The ongoing search for the Fountain of Youth.
That's right. No. That's right. It continues. It's alive and well and probably is immortal.
Jonathan Weiner, his book Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality, is just out in paperback from Echo. Jonathan, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks
for
having me.